You're listening to Let's Talk on Talk Radio Europe. In nearly 20 years at the top of the news of the world, Neville Thirlbeck, chief reporter, news editor, and certainly scoop hunter extraordinaire, served up some of the most famous, memorable, and astonishing headlines in the paper's existence. Now, in Tabloid Secrets, he reveals for the first time the truth about how he broke the stories that thrilled, excited, and shocked the nation. It's a fascinating read, and I'm delighted to welcome Neville to the show. Thanks for joining us, Neville.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Well, where better to start than right back at the very beginning? When you left Sunderland in 1980, I guess, like most teenagers, you didn't have a clue what you were going to do with your life.
Absolutely no idea whatsoever. bit like most sort of 18-year-olds, I had to sort of just find my way and find something I was good at. And that's always the most difficult thing, isn't it? Not only finding something that you like doing, but that you can do well. So that
Absolutely.
Was the big challenge.
You took a job, curiously, as an English teacher in the Sudan.
Yes, it was. It was, again, it was just by chance. The advert popped up, had nothing to do. I'd just graduated. It looked interesting. It sounded interesting. And off I went.
And your route into journalism was rather like the proper way to do it, if you like. I mean, you know, I'm a musician, and they always say about musicians, unless you've travelled up and down the M6 in the white transit van, you haven't really paid your dues. And you certainly did that, didn't you, early on?
Well, in those days, it was a very traditional route in, was to sort of, you know, try and do a bit of freelancing, get taken on, persuade a newspaper, a local newspaper, to take you on. And in those days, they used to pay you to train you.
Brilliant.
Which was very, very helpful, and they did that, the Harrow Observer.
Wow.
The year-old Harrow Observer did that, and then I went on to Fleet Street.
Yes, and you ended up selling a story to the News of the World because I think they offered you around 750 quid for a piece. That must have been extraordinary, having worked on the Harrow Observer.
Well, it was. I think I was earning probably that, you know, a month. And
yeah.
The News of the World offered me a handsome sum for a story, and I asked them to, I sort of negotiated with them and said I'd accept the money, but I wanted 2 weeks of work to show what I could do. So that's how I got my foot in the door.
Well, good for you. And I guess that first day at work, I mean, can you remember it? There you are, what, 26 years old. Most of them in there are seasoned veterans. They're the kind of A-team, aren't they, that you're aspiring to be?
Well, yes, there was a lot of the journalists on the paper in those days had been there since the early 1960s, late 1950s, and they were sort of, they were big names, and I was in awe of them, and I expected the first day of the News of the World to be difficult, to be a bit like sort of Dante's Inferno,
of course,
flames coming up from the typewriter and so forth, but it was quite the opposite. It was. They were very, very charming people, and very easy to get along with, and extremely welcoming. I was very, very surprised indeed.
And it was all going rather well. You were just about to get a staff job, and then unfortunately you got fired for a rather bizarre reason.
Yeah, booted off, kicked off, fired. I crashed in flames. Unfortunately. I was accused by the editor, who was rather suspicious of leaks going from the paper. Well, that's quite common on Sunday newspapers because sub-editors work for several newspapers, freelancing, and chatter happens and stories get leaked. Well, she couldn't find the source of the leak, and she thought, quite wrongly, that I was a spy for the Sunday Mirror. So she kicked me out. The news desk thought it would all die down. They brought me back in 6 weeks later, and she just looked at me from the other end of the newsroom, pointed at me, and told them to throw me out a second time. So,
good Lord.
That was the end of that for a short period of time. Anyway.
Yeah, she left. You eventually got back in, and Piers Morgan arrived, and I think you were one of his first hirings, weren't you?
Yes, Piers took me on, I think, virtually the first week that he took over from that particular editor. And he very kindly offered me a job, and that was 1994,
yes. He's done all right since then, hasn't he, as well?
He has, yeah, and we're still in touch.
Good. Now, 17 years you then stayed there, and you describe it yourself as dramatic and exotic, and I think that's a bit of an understatement. Can we paint a picture of in those days, how important the News of the World was?
Well, when I first started, it was selling 5 million copies every Sunday, approximately just under three people per copy was read. So for every edition sold, approximately three people read it. So the readership was around about just under 15 million, and that was in the population in those days of about 58 million, and which is a sizable part of the population. It was very, very, very well read indeed.
Yes, and you're up against, in terms of the newspaper journalism bit and breaking the big stories, some very sharp operators, and of course you've only got one chance in a week to shine.
That's the difficulty with working on a Sunday newspaper, and that is you might gather together an exclusive scoop on a Tuesday or a Wednesday, and then the big fear was that one of your rivals on the dailies, let's say the Daily Mail, might break the story on a Friday, leaving you with nothing for the Sunday. So it could be quite... it was high-octane stuff, but highly competitive.
Yeah.
Very cut and thrust, obviously. That was the nature of the game. Still is in many respects. But nonetheless, it was, it was fun.
Yes, and in those days, we're talking here about really money being no object in terms of budgets for you as well, aren't we?
Well, the extraordinary thing was, in the 70s and 80s, just really ending by the time I arrived, when I first started in 1988, there wasn't even a budget. The News of the World was so well off that the news editor would simply have to ask the editor for the money to buy the story. And there wasn't any real financial accountability as such in terms of budgets. I mean, that changed, but still there was several million pounds per year to run, a news desk. So it was very financially stable, let's put it that way.
Yes, I mean, in terms of you and your expenses, that must have been wonderful. I mean, I did read a story of when you had to were told to follow the Princess of Wales to the south of France, and your budget there was extraordinary for expenses.
Yes, it was. It was, unfortunately, or fortunately, depends how you look at it, the Princess of Wales tended to stay at very, very expensive hotels. So if you were watching, what was going on, and there was a lot of extremely dramatic things that were going on within her life and the royal family at the time, then obviously you would pitch up maybe at the same hotel as her. So that might be, Hotel du Cap d'Antibes or something, which I think was about £600 the cheapest room, and that was 20-odd years ago. So it would be kind of eye-wateringly expensive. That's not to say that we were frivolous. I mean, one had to account for every penny that was spent. And I was never fortunately accused of overspending or being frivolous. But they were very good in terms of giving you the resources to get the story done. And if it meant, certain expenses had to be paid, then they were always met.
Some of those stories were just groundbreaking in terms of the journalism and what you uncovered. I mean, people remember that Jeffrey Archer's perjury story, David Beckham's affairs, and that was a sensational scoop and also sensational sales, which don't always go together necessarily.
Yes, that's true. They did create a huge sales spike, those stories, and they won two awards, actually, as well. So they did me and the paper a lot of good. And, the Jeffrey Archer story in particular was very important because I proved that he'd committed perjury during his libel trial and he went to prison. And that was a very important story for us because the newspaper had lost heavily, both financially and reputationally, as did the Daily Star, when we lost the initial libel action that he'd taken, which was built on a false alibi. And the editor of the Star, Lloyd Turner, who I knew very, very well indeed, he left there with his career in ruins, and he he died soon after. So we were very, very pleased to put the record straight.
With the Rebecca Lewes story, you have a local connection to us here as we sit in Marbella, because you holed up in Sotto Grande, didn't you?
Yes, just up down the coast from you.
Yeah.
We had the whole of... The reason why we went to Sotto Grande was because we had the whole of Fleet Street in hot pursuit after I broke the story to try to find Rebecca and me. So we sort of hopped it in the middle of the night, went on the run, jumped in a car, drove south from Madrid, through the night and pitched up at a villa. It was a villa that I needed to rent, and I didn't want to leave any trail, I seem to remember, and instead of going to an estate agent and hiring direct, I just went straight to the owner and dealt with him one-to-one and negotiated a deal, and we hid her in seclusion for, I think, about four or five weeks. But that was a kind of a covert operation that we had to man to keep the rest of, literally the world's press, it was actually. They were from all over the world, as far away as Tokyo, because Beckham had a very international reputation, so there were literally hundreds of people desperately trying to find us, but we managed to evade them for, I think, about a month.
I can't imagine it was the worst job in the world, having to spend a month with Rebecca Lewes.
Well, she was very easy to get along with. Sometimes it can be. You know, everybody says when you're on the road with a beautiful woman, then that must be the best job in the world. Believe you me, it's not. It can be an absolute nightmare. These particular ladies can be very, very high maintenance, quite flaky, and difficult to manage. And it can be. It was the sort of job that I never really wanted. These types of stories, but I found myself on this one, and I have to say that Rebecca was a dream. She was extremely intelligent, highly personable, a lot of fun, and very easy to get on with. So we had a lot of fun out there together. She obviously was quite a roller coaster for her, but we all got through it in the end.
And during the 1990s, you did spend, on the other side of the coin, a lot of time undercover exposing gun runners, drug dealers, money launderers, paedophiles, some pretty tough cookies in there.
Yes, there were. And in order to expose these types of people, you had to get to know villains very well. So you had to hope that villains would become your friends and then introduce you into particular gangs. So you'd be leading a very strange double life, posing as a gun runner or a paedophile or a drug dealer. And so you had to be sort of, pretty much alert to the danger of being rumbled by a gang, which was not obviously a great career move. And but fortunately, I managed to evade detection.
Yes, and you went on to be a rather fertile source for information concerning serious organised crime, and did some work as Agent 251 for the National Criminal Intelligence Service.
Yes, I did. That was another unusual part of the job. You're laughing now, Bill. I'm looking back, and I laugh too, because it is an extraordinary part of my job, which took me into very quiet parts of the establishment, and it was a symbiotic relationship.
Yes.
So they would give me information, and I would give them information in return, and that's the way it worked quite happily for a number of years, anyway.
Yes, and you had also a relationship with MI5. Was that not symbiotic?
That was not symbiotic, no. It was very much... there was a lot of material that I gathered when I was a chief crime reporter, for example, that would have... I would get information or receive information on terrorism. And that's an extremely dangerous subject for a one-man band like Neville Thurlbeck to handle.
Mm.
And it would have been irresponsible for me to try to solve and crack very complex terrorist activity. So it was incumbent upon me to pass it on. So it went through NSIS, and then, of course, NSIS was actually a stepping stone, a bridge between Special Branch and the security services, which eventually led me to the security services, obviously, and I had a one-to-one relationship with them for many years, and that was not symbiotic. It was very one-way.
In 2009, as we know, events took a turn for the worse, to say the least, at the News of the World, and you got yourself embroiled in one of the biggest scandals of recent times.
Yes, indeed, I did. Mm. That was the phone hacking debacle at News International. Unfortunately, we were, a lot of us got caught up in that. We've thankfully come out of the other side now, several years later, but I tend to sort of look back on those days and say, well, what could we have done differently as a team? And at the end of the day, we took legal advice on everything we did at the News of the World, and we had a series, we had a battery of very experienced lawyers and barristers, and they advised that if providing it was in the public interest, then it was an acceptable practice. And in fact, the staff handbook even said that was the case as well. Unfortunately, when it went to court, the public interest argument was not allowed because it's not allowed in law when it comes to voicemail interception. So we lost that. It's a battle we lost, but I don't cry over spilt milk. It's one of those things that can happen when you work at the very sharp end of any industry, but particularly journalism. Regrettable. And thankfully, me and my colleagues now largely have moved on.
Yes, I mean, I guess that's part of the point of writing this book, that most of your work at the News of the World was old-fashioned journalistic techniques and not this illegal news-gathering practices.
Yes, I think phone hacking came across my radar less than a handful of times. That it came across my radar at all is a matter of sincere regret. But yes, I would say, you know, 99.9% of the rest of the time it was old-fashioned journalism, and that's why I wrote the book, because I just wanted to give everybody a flavour of what it was really like. There's a tendency to now look at it through the prism of the phone hacking trial, and that will give it slightly, or I'd rather say actually, a hugely distorted picture of what life was like there on the paper. Mm. So I thought that the very least I could explain it is through the stories that I wrote, how we actually went about gathering them.
Do you regret not telling Rebecca Brooks about phone hacking? Do you regret not knocking on her door?
Yes, I've said that before. I am on record. I did try. I went to the senior editors on the paper and said, I think we need to go to Rebecca about this and discuss X, Y, and Z. That was forbidden. It was absolutely not. We won't be doing that. And leave it at that. Very firmly, you know. And I know Rebecca. I knew her and know her. And I certainly would have been allowed an audience with her. I used to be her editor, a news editor when she was editor. So when she was chief executive officer, you know, I could have knocked on her door. She would have seen me. And in retrospect, and I'm on record of saying this, Bill, I think I should have ignored, as dangerous as it would be to ignore an editor's order, perhaps in retrospect I should have brought matters to her attention in greater detail, but in the hindsight, as they say.
Yes, indeed. I mean, there have been obviously many casualties, not least the newspaper itself. Do you think that was the right thing to do, to close the
newspaper? No, I don't. World? And I know for a fact that Rupert Murdoch doesn't think now it was the right thing to do, and rather wished he hadn't been railroaded into closing it. Mm. I think the newspaper deserved better than that. Rupert Murdoch is a custodian as well as the owner. He's the custodian of a national brand, whether you like it or not, whether people like it or don't like it. Certainly it was enjoyed by a majority of people, and it had been for five or six generations. It ought to have been looked after rather better than it was when it came to its denouement.
And your view of Andy Coulson, I believe I've seen you on record saying that he's a fundamentally good man, in your view.
He is. There's no doubt about that. I've known Andy for 29 years, and he's fundamentally a very decent man. He, like all editors, has his critics. Obviously not the easiest man in the world, what editor is. An editor has to control the wild egos and eccentricities of maybe 50, 60, 100 journalists. And in order to do that, You have to be very tough, otherwise they'll do it their way, not your way.
Yeah.
So you have to be tough. And he is certainly a very tough man. I personally found him very tough, very fair, and also an incredibly brilliant editor too.
In terms of the public, do you think the public would have continued to support the News of the World after things like the Millie Dowler story?
I think in those days, Twitter was relatively in its infancy. And there was what we now call a Twitter storm.
Yeah.
And that gave, I think, a very powerful message to the proprietor, which led him to close the paper. But I think now we know that Twitter, for all its wonderful facets, is quite heavily biased towards the left, shall we say. Mm. And there was a lot of agitation, sort of left of centre agitation, for doing a lot of good. I'm not criticising this. Mm. It's a useful and very, very effective platform. But there is the danger sometimes of thinking, because so many people on Twitter are saying this, this is a majority opinion.
Yeah.
And I don't think that's necessarily reflective of the nation as a whole.
Mm. In reading your book, I get the impression that despite, for you personally, having paid a high price, you spent 37 days in prison, your enthusiasm for the heyday of the newspaper industry has not been dimmed.
It's not dimmed at all, no. I'm very realistic about life, and I've always just got on with it. And now I've got my own PR company, Clear Vista Media. Sorry to plug that.
Not at all.
I'm trying to give a sort of a context as to where I am now. And I wouldn't be where I am now. I mean, it is a highly successful company, Bill. It's more successful financially than I was when I was on the News of the World.
Mm.
And I wouldn't be there had it not been for what I've been doing for the past 25 years. So I can't look back with regret. And life is tough. But I always thought one thing is for sure, and that is, as tough as this might be, I'm not being asked to go up in a Spitfire and shoot down the Luftwaffe with a three-week life expectancy, or stand in a trench with a Lee Enfield rifle pointing into no man's land in 2 feet of mud with 10 days life expectancy. Like the vast majority of my family, and probably your family, were expected in days gone by. This was just, you know, in comparison, it was just a minor inconvenience.
Yeah.
And I set myself apart from the problem by looking at, you know, how awful life has been for our predecessors and now our contemporaries, you know, throughout the vast majority of the world. I can't complain. I literally cannot find it within me to complain.
And if the phone went after we finish our interview here and it was Rupert Murdoch asking you to work for him, would you?
I've got too much on my plate to work for anybody else. I've had several offers. I'm doing a bit of TV work at the moment. I'm doing a lot of work for clients. And it keeps me busy for literally 7 days a week, sometimes from 6 in the morning till 11 or 12 at night. Just the thought of actually devoting my entire life to one particular company, again, it was extreme. I can't even conceive of it, to be honest with you.
Interesting. Well, it's a really good book, and it really does show the kind of glory days of journalism brilliantly. Tabloid Secrets, Neville Thirlbeck, thank you so much for joining us, and let's hope you get some time off shortly then.
Indeed, and thanks for having me on the show, Bill.
Not a problem at all. It's been a pleasure, sir.
All the best.